Hello and welcome to Banking Matters. I'm your host, Roger Morris. Today on the podcast, I am pleased to welcome back Pat Huttenbach. He is a litigation attorney at Crane, Caton & James. He boasts an impressive track record spanning more than 25 years dedicated to assisting banks in navigating and litigating matters related to the Uniform Commercial Code. Based on that experience, we previously had him on the podcast to discuss check fraud issues, and that conversation went so well, we thought we needed him back on to talk about a new topic, wire fraud. So welcome back, Pat.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into this. So, you know, since you've been on before, we'll change our typical first question. So we got your legal origin story. So what was your, I guess, UCC and wire fraud origin story? How did you first get into these issues?
Well, originally back in the 90s, the banking industry was changing. People were saying that the checks were not going to be around. Ha, they're still around, you know, all these years later. But people really thought it was going to be, and you know, much more wire stuff, and you know, Zelle, of course, was years away. But things like that, there's going to be new payment methods that were going to be developed. So early on, I started, you know, learning quite a bit about wire fraud. A lot of people still don't know that, you know, wire fraud or the UCC Article 4A is different than Article 3 and 4, and that's where funds transfers and wire transfers are governed, is under 4A. So when I first started, there was there's only 16 cases in the whole nation under 4A, and now there's, you know, many, many more. So,
well, that leads into my next question. You know, oftentimes on the Compliance Hub hotline, we'll get questions just wanting to know where we're at in the law. So with wire fraud, I think we've already given it kind of away. Where are we at in the law? What are we dealing with?
So wire fraud is similar to other types of fraud. The key issue is authority. And I think you're going to ask me some questions about how wire fraud occurs. So, but the key for any bank in thinking about wire fraud is, can they prove that their customer truly authorized the wire transfer that was sent? Because very rarely do these get caught ahead of time. Usually it's a wire has gone out and then customer says, well, I didn't authorize that, or I didn't mean to go to that particular person or that particular bank. So that's how wire fraud unfolds. But the key for any bank is, if you're questioned on the wire transfer, how are you going to show that your customer truly authorized that wire transfer?
Gotcha. So what qualifies as wire fraud?
Well, there's several different ways it can unfold. A wire transfer is also defined as a fund transfer under 4A of the UCC. And basically, a bank will get a set of instructions. It can be via fax, telephone, email, in person. But a customer will fill out what's called a wire transfer request form. And the wire transfer request form can be filled out by the bank, but basically it tells the bank, I want you to wire transfer, let's say $100,000 from our customer's account and send it over to a beneficiary at a recipient bank. So let's say you're at Bank ABC, you work with Bank ABC, your customer wants to wire transfer $100,000. You say, where do you want it sent? And they fill out either email or form. Hey, I want this $100,000 to be sent to, you know, Bank XYZ, and I want bank account number 123 to get this money. So that's kind of how a wire unfolds. Usually they go through the Fedwire system, but it's a payment method where you're not like writing a check, or a customer's not writing a check. It's a request from a bank to send money directly from your account to another account in another bank.
Okay, well, we've defined, you know, what wire fraud is and defined some of the situations it occurs. But, you know, once a bank is informed of wire fraud, what should the first steps be?
Well, the first step should always be trying to do an immediate recall. That's kind of the, if you want to get those funds frozen as fast as possible. So if you are at Bank ABC and your customer says this $100,000 didn't get to my intended recipient, then you got to figure out, where did that money go, contact that bank, and get that bank to freeze it. In the old days, banks were much more likely to participate and cooperate in trying to stop wire fraud. You know, you would go to these conferences, whether it's the Fraud Investigator Association of Texas or other similar banking conferences, and you'd know contacts of the banks and say, hey, we just sent you this money, and now it's apparently not going to the right person, and they call and they'd freeze it. The banks would send like a hold harmless form to say, okay, we'll freeze it and hold it. You know, we won't let our customer have it. The key is, once the customer gets the money, they quickly try to get the money out of the recipient's bank and then move it on to other banks. And they launder the money through several banks usually. So the key is, once you hear about it, act quickly. Time is of the essence, because unlike a hold on a check, you know, the bank that received these funds, they will put a hold on a check if something's suspicious. They may or may not put a hold on suspicious wire transfer because those funds are guaranteed funds. They don't have to wait for the check to clear. So time is of the essence. You need to immediately act to try to stop it. And one thing you can do is file a lawsuit and get a temporary restraining order, but we'll talk more about that later.
Well, that leads into my next question. So, I mean, at a certain point, if the other bank's not willing to play ball, you know, it becomes a litigation issue, you know, but before you get to that point, you know, what happens or at what point should a bank be saying, all right, I need to consult with my lawyer?
Urgently, the second you hear, and wire fraud, you know, comes from several different, you know, avenues, whether it's a business email compromise, account takeover, the fraudster tricks the customer, or the customer's instructions to the bank are intercepted by a fraudster, or the fraudster infiltrates the customer's computer and sends out legitimate instructions. And we could dive into those a little bit later on. Those are the most common fact patterns. But once the customer hears that the money they thought was supposed to go over to the other bank did not go to that bank, sometimes it might be a wire transfer sent to Chase and the fraudster changes the instructions and it's sent to Wells. And so you've got to immediately get that bank to freeze the money. And sometimes the other bank is more cooperative than others. What I like to tell my clients is, you know, depending on the amount of the wire, if it's a, you know, $3,000 wire or $5,000 wire, I would go through the normal channels of calling the bank, ask them to freeze it, offer to do a hold harmless. Those are some of the more normal channels. And a hold harmless just says, you know, bank receiving bank or beneficiary bank, don't give the money to your customer, freeze the money. And if your customer sues you, I'll indemnify you. I'll hold you harmless from claims against your customer, but your customer's not entitled to that money. So that's a way that banks between each other can freeze the money. If those avenues don't work, or if it's a larger wire, if you're talking 20, 50, 100,000 or $1 million wire, if I were the bank, I'd have an attorney go down to a court, file a lawsuit against the receiving bank, and you've got certain statutory rights under the UCC, but you also still have your routine money hadn't received unjust enrichment claims and say, look, this $100,000 that was sent to you, you don't have a claim to that money. There's some fraud here. And so that customer was never supposed to get that money. And you can go down to a court and seek what's called a temporary restraining order. And in Harris County, there's a special judge that sits, an ancillary judge, that you can schedule an immediate temporary restraining order. And you run down there and say, Judge, we don't want this money to disappear. Please immediately order the bank to freeze the funds. You have to post a bond. Usually it's $500 or $1,000. And then you get the judge to sign a temporary restraining order saying, you know, Bank ABC, who received the money, do not let go of this money. Freeze the money. And it maintains a status quo because in the next couple hours, the next couple days, that money could be gone. That receiving bank might, you know, release the hold. The customer might sweet talk a teller into giving up some or all the money. But getting that temporary restraining order is as fast as possible is the best thing you can do because then you've got the money frozen. The next step after a temporary restraining order is in under Texas law, you've got 14 days to have a temporary injunction hearing, and you can get one extension for another 14 days. But the key is lock that money down as quickly as possible.
Gotcha. Well, I feel like banks, you know, you're very familiar with the check fraud process, you know, how liability is determined in there, you know, when liability can be placed on the customer, them, or the other bank. But under wire fraud, I feel like there's kind of some confusion. So can you walk us through, you know, how the liability process, when, you know, can you place the blame on who?
So wire fraud is completely different than bank fraud in a lot of respects, check fraud in a lot of respects. In check fraud, there are warranties that as the depository bank, you're making to the maker's bank saying this check is not altered, our customer has a right to the funds, all signatures on the check are valid. Those are the standard transfer presentment warranties. Wire fraud, you have different warranties, and there are no similar transfer warranties because one bank is sending the money to another bank. And the receiving bank, they don't have any, they have no control over who is supposed to get the money because the customer's bank sending the wire transfer That's the one that determines we want this money to go to this customer and to this account. So, but it's very hard to get liability on a bank that who all they're doing is receiving some money, and you know they didn't control who gave them the money or not. So there's a lot of case law out there that says if you're receiving the money for a beneficiary of this wire transfer, there's very limited ways you can be held liable. The top two or three ways that you can be held liable is if you put the money in the wrong account. So if it's supposed to go to Bob Smith in account 123, and your internal system messes that up and you give it to Dave Jones in account number 456. So that's a common claim. Another common claim under the UCC-4A is misdescription of beneficiary. If the number and the name on the account don't match, well, then the question is, do you have a fully automated system? You go through some other things, but that could create some liability if, again, they put it in the wrong account and if there's human intervention in those type of situations. If the receiving bank has all these indication or badges of fraud, there's some ways to try to get liability that way. Most of the liability is going to be on the sending bank who's sending out the wire transfer, because that's where their customer's going to say the money didn't get to the proper person and you didn't have commercially reasonable security procedures to stop an unauthorized wire transfer. So there's a lot more to discuss on that end. But if you're receiving the funds, that's why I said you need to bring money hadn't received or unjust enrichment type of claim to try to stop that money laundering wire fraud.
Gotcha. What steps can banks take to help mitigate wire fraud risk?
Have a good callback procedure. I had a bank once that called me and said, "Hey, I've got a wire fraud problem." We did a callback, and the customer sent an $800,000 wire. And when they sent the instructions, the fraudster intercepted that email. And then instead of going to bank ABC, the fraudster said, "I want to send $800,000 to bank XYZ for $800,000." So when the callback came, they said, "Did you just do an $800,000 wire transfer?" And the customer said, "Yep." They didn't check the little details about the, did you send it to this number or this bank? They just said, "Did you do it?" "Yep." And then that cost an $800,000 loss. So that's one. You really want to watch out for the business email compromise and then the infiltration issues. On a business email compromise, an email will get changed. So it'll be, Bob Jones at company, company.com. And then the fraudsters will intercept an email and they'll change the company to CONPANY. So the bank thinks they're dealing with their customer, but instead they're dealing with a fraudster. So there's one little change in an email that can create a bunch of fraud. Another way that that this happens all the time is a customer's computer gets infiltrated and then a legitimate email from the legitimate email address. So there's no changing of the email, but the fraudster is in their computer. And so what happens is they send an email to the bank. "Hey, I want to add, Bob left the company, our external VP, our treasurer. Now we're adding Sally." And so then they say, "So we need to have paperwork to add, remove and add an authorized signer for doing wires." Bank says, "Okay," and sends a legitimate form to a legitimate email address. Well, the customer never sees it because the fraudster, when they get in their computer, and the way they get in their computer is clicking the link. Someone at that customer clicks a link, fraudster then gets in their computer and sets up rules that all these emails are put into a hidden folder. So customer has no idea what's going on. But fraudster then fills out the form, signs it and says, "Hey, I need you to, now give the give Sally administrative rights to wires and to other things," and legitimate email sends that back. And so now the bank adds the Sally. And then when Sally does a wire transfer, the bank thinks, "Hey, I've got an authorized person doing this transfer." And now, this person, the customer says, "I've never heard of Sally." And so you've got an authorized versus unauthorized wire transfer problem. Ways to combat that is to have some policies and procedures that, if you add somebody, you might need to call the original people, not just confirm via email and say that. That's boots and suspenders. Is that needed? That's probably above what's really needed. But again, I'm just brainstorming as to how you can prevent it. If a new person does a wire, are you called? Do they have a new callback number in the new forms? Maybe you still call the old callback number too. Those are just some ideas to try to prevent that type of wire fraud. But that's also, it's called an account takeover attack type of wire fraud. Very hard to prevent because you are getting, as a bank, a legitimate email, legitimate communication from the exact email address you're expecting. And how do you really combat that? Because when the customer's fault, they got their computer hacked. So those are some of the more recent types of wire fraud.
Gotcha. Well, let's say, you know, you're a bank and, you know, unfortunately there is some wire fraud and then they hire Pat to help litigate their case. What are the things a bank can do to help their attorney, to help Pat make their claim?
So first check if you have insurance. A lot of banks do not have insurance for a lot of other issues like check fraud, but sometimes a lot of my clients actually have good insurance for wire fraud. Now you might have a high deductible, but most of the time the wire transfers are pretty high, the amounts of the wire transfers. So do that. You want to freeze that money as quickly as possible. So I've even hired attorneys in Hong Kong to try to get money, but it's wow. Usually within days that it's gone. So, you know, if the money is sent overseas, you know, another type of issue that comes up is if the customer is tricked into sending a wire, they'll be asked to deposit a check, or they'll, you know, get a text saying, "Hey, I need you to pay this vendor." It's a false email from the president of the treasurer, and again, all on the customer side saying, "Send 100,000," and this is a legitimate wire transfer. And customers get scammed all the time. I want the bank to send this money to this person at this other bank. Bank complies with those instructions, and later on, the customer says, "Well, I didn't really want that to happen." But gather up all the facts as much as possible that show that, you know, you did what you could. There is, you know, what else is the bank supposed to do? A customer is telling the bank, "I want to spend my money in this manner." But the key is speed. Don't dwell on it. Immediately send a recall. Immediately, you know, offer to do a hold harmless with the other bank. Call your contacts at the other bank. I've got a lot of contacts at other banks, and hopefully your attorneys that for banks have contacts that they can call and say, "I mean, I got called, I think it was like 10 years ago now, on Good Friday. I was at the beach with my family, and like it was like $1 million or $2 million of wire transfers went out, and we were calling banks all over the country, begging them to shut this down. And we got back, I think, like, you know, $1 million or $1.5 out of $2 million. And we were just begging. I was calling from the beach in my shorts, just saying, "Please freeze this money and freeze it fast." So that's one of the best things you can do is that quickly. And then race to the courthouse, get that TRO if you're worried that the bank's not going to cooperate. And some banks do and some banks don't, and it depends on the bank. Get a TRO ASAP, so the bank is ordered by a court to freeze those funds. So,
gotcha. What trends have you seen in wire fraud? Is it, you know, more and more prevalent every year, like check fraud? What have you seen in the industry?
I mean, it's the sophistication of the bad guys is just unbelievable. And they can hack into accounts now. They click a link. The customer clicks a link. They're in their computer system. It's just so easy to get into a computer system. Customers need to just improve their security. Don't click those links. And then, you know, you quickly learn that there's a lot of different ways that it can occur, but there's probably three or four main ones. Just look at those and say, "How can I, you know, try to prevent that? And do I have insurance to cover that?" So those are just some of the basic things. You also want to have a good wire transfer agreement because you want to make sure the customer does have good security. So you want to have provisions in your wire agreement that says, "Customer, you know, don't send a routine email, send encrypted emails." You want provisions in your wire agreement that says that, you know, they agree that they're going to go for callbacks. You don't want, and you want to recommend other security procedures to them. And if they don't agree to them, then that could be on the customer if wire fraud happens. I mean, you can lead a horse to water, but if they don't accept all your recommendations and they suffer a loss, that's unfortunately could be bad. You know, a court could say that's on the customer. And then also, just like you've got a timely reporting requirement for checks, make sure that, you know, they timely report wire fraud. UCC 4A505 says that they have 1 year to report it. I would put a provision in your bank's wire agreement to say, "Hey, you should report this within 30 days. And There's several courts out there. There's a federal court out of Florida that said you cannot limit it down from 1 year down to 30 days. There's New York, New Jersey courts that say you cannot limit it down, but Louisiana, they do allow you to limit it down. Minnesota allows you to limit it down. I think I'm the only attorney in Texas that have litigated that issue. And to my knowledge, I'm not aware of a single other appellate court that has litigated it, but I handled a case for a bank client, won a summary judgment on that exact issue, went up to the Court of Appeals, and it was affirmed, but the opinion written was bank not only wins, but bank gets their attorney's fees back against the customer. So I don't have a great opinion on timely reporting of wire transfers, like an appellate opinion, but you should definitely have the provision in your deposit agreement to limit their time limit down to 30 days or so, because we think Texas courts will enforce that. And again, it goes state by state. Some states do, some states won't.
Gotcha. Well, Pat, I've really appreciated having you on. It's been a really helpful conversation for our listeners and for me as well on wire fraud. But I'd like to end with our closing question. What one piece of advice do you have to share with our listeners today?
Just be vigilant on all these issues, and common sense is probably the key. You know, if you hear that your customer has experienced wire fraud and, you know, they're going to have a, oh my goodness moment, just be sympathetic to them and then act fast. You know, don't go take a lunch break. Don't go, if you can't get a hold of your boss asking what to do, just start making phone calls, whether to your attorney, to the other bank, freeze the money. Minutes, seconds could matter in wire fraud just because the funds are so easily received and immediately transferred. You want to act quickly, and just common sense on how to go about trying to get that money back.
Well, thanks again, Pat, for coming on today. We really appreciate it. And for our listeners out there, that's Banking Matters.